This is Kathy bringing you the second half of the pantograph for Wednesday, the 8th of June. And I'm going to move to page 3. And the headline today reads, Jilted Girlfriend Allegedly Bleaches Ex's Clothes and Steals Shoes, from Tony Reed. A jilted longtime girlfriend is facing criminal damage and theft charges after she allegedly took revenge on her ex-boyfriend by bleaching his clothes and confiscating one each from 3 pairs of his shoes. Ashley L. Shelley, 30, was arrested by Decatur police on Monday and booked on a charge of causing damage that will cost more than $300 to fix and stealing the shoes. Police allege the offenses date back to May 31st, when Shelley's 27-year-old boyfriend, with whom she lived, told her he did not want to be with her anymore, and their 8-year relationship was over. He had packed some of his shoes and clothes and left them by the door of their apartment before he left for his shift at a fast food restaurant. He told police Shelley had later confronted him there and was very upset. He advised her that he did not want to go back to the residence after work because of Shelley's demeanor, the sworn statements say. The ex-boyfriend later called and asked when he could get his clothes back. Shelley is then said to have turned up June 1st at his grandmother's house where he was staying with his things. He advised he looked at his clothes and shoe boxes after Shelley left to see that he was missing one shoe each from 3 different pairs of Nike Air Force Ones, the sworn statements say. He advised his clothing had also been bleached. The orphan's shoes were valued at $270, and the bleached clothes will cost $350 to replace, according to police. Officers who investigated confirmed the shoes were missing and took pictures of the clothes ruined by bleach. Shelley remained in the Macon County Jail Tuesday in lieu of posting a $3,000 bond. If she makes bail, she is ordered to stay away from her former boyfriend's residence. Headline, Schools Again Face Fall Session with No Funding Plan in Place, by Valerie Wells. In the summer of 2015, the state of Illinois had not yet passed a budget, and public schools statewide stewed over whether they'd have the money to open in August. Welcome to summer reruns. Legislators appropriated enough money to open schools in 2015, but never passed a budget, and this year the same effort is underway. In a conference call with media on Tuesday, Secretary of Education Beth Purvis talked about State Senate Bill 3434 and House Bill 6583, which would fund schools without a state budget. We're unfortunately 3 weeks out from the new fiscal year, which begins on July 1st, and superintendents, principals, teachers, and parents are working to get ready for the new school year, and no funding formula is in place, Purvis said. The legislators have been discussing a change in the school funding formula for a very long time. They can't come to an agreement on that either. And since 2009, state budget shortfalls have meant that schools' general state aid has been prorated, with districts receiving only a percentage of the foundation level of $6,119 per student. State aid is figured based on enrollment, local property values, and the number of students eligible for free or reduced price lunches, and poorer districts are heavily dependent on that state aid, with districts receiving only 92% of their allotment in FY 2016. Purvis said the two bills would end that proration and additionally include a hold harmless provision, ensuring that no district would receive less money than it did in this fiscal year. Chicago Public Schools stood to lose $74 million due to declining enrollment, for example, and the bills add funding for early childhood education and line items for programs like agricultural education and after-school matters, which is unique to Chicago schools. This is a bridge year proposal to open schools on time while committing to a new formula of equity and adequacy, Purvis said. Questions during the conference call from media around the state included several on what schools would do if these bills didn't pass. Both are still in committee and have not made it to the legislators for a vote, she said. With 3 weeks to go, Purvis said, the hope is that the bills will be in place before July 1, and if not, the Illinois State Board of Education is available to offer guidance to the state's 862 school districts, many of which will have tough financial decisions to make if no funding is available from the state. The General Assembly adjourned its spring session on May 31st. From Bloomington, Rauner, the headline reads, Rauner, Public Pressure Needed for Budget and School Funding, Julia Evelsizer. An outcry from the people of Illinois is the only answer for cutting through more than a year of gridlock and getting at least a stopgap state budget and a full year of school funding, according to Governor Bruce Rauner. Speaking on Education funding on Tuesday at the regional alternative school in downtown Bloomington, Rauner blamed the budget impasse on the Democratic majority in the General Assembly, led by House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat of Chicago. "We need the people of Illinois to stand up, make phone calls, send emails, and come to Springfield and knock on doors," said Rauner. "Tell the General Assembly to pass a stopgap budget and pass a full-year school funding bill so our teachers and students can come first." School superintendents and administrators from Pantograph area districts, including Leroy, Stanford-based Olympia, Bloomington District 87, and Normal-based McLean County Unit 5, listened and asked questions during Rauner's visit. Glenn Hoffman, RAS director, said he has been telling teachers and families to write to Springfield for months. "We can also do things like we did today, bring the governor here for a tour, and to hear him speak. To me, that's the one hope we have, to put a face and a name to the students in our program," said Hoffman. The alternative school served nearly 1,200 students last year. RAS serves students in just central Illinois who have a variety of academic, social, economic, or behavioral issues. Without funding from the state, the school has enough reserves to stay open until March of 2017. Without funding, however, RAS will have to severely cut back, if not cease, most of the programming offered, said Mark Jontree, superintendent of the Regional Office of Education 17, which serves DeWitt, Livingston, Logan, and McLean counties. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley asked the governor what the game plan will be if July 1st, the start of the state's fiscal year, rolls around with no budget in sight. Rauner reiterated his belief that Illinois residents should put pressure on Madigan to approve Rauner's proposed bills to keep the state afloat through January and to fund primary and secondary schools for a full year. "There is no solution or magic money appears to fund schools other than if the General Assembly passes a school funding bill. There's no reason that can't pass," said Rauner. Riley said that was the answer he expected to hear. "That's the only answer he can truly give. It seems there are some differences in philosophies as to how this budget should be done, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of room for negotiating," said Riley. This next is an editorial. Increase fees, but don't limit licenses. Anyone who has driven around Decatur can confirm what the City Council learned on Monday night. Video gaming is growing fast. During a study session, the Council found that as of March, there were 72 establishments and 338 video gaming terminals. That's quite a growth since 2012, when the city had 3 sites with 14 gaming terminals. Video gaming is also big money. During 2015, about $70 million was spent on the machines. About $52 million was paid back to the gamblers, with the machine owners, local businesses, state and city governments splitting up the rest. The city's take was almost $900,000. A lot of the growth is due to a new class of liquor license that the city established in 2015. The Class P liquor license is specifically for gaming parlors that aren't a part of an existing bar or tavern. Council member Jerry Dawson, who also serves as the city's liquor commissioner, said that the original intent of the state law was to help out struggling taverns. "I didn't know about this other segment of the community that really don't want to go to taverns, but they want to gamble. Few others predicted this kind of growth." The question is whether the council should curb the growth of video gaming parlors, increase the license fees for the machines, or a combination of both. Increasing the license fees is an easy bet. The fees of other cities per machine range from zero in Champaign to $1,000 in Urbana. The current Decatur fee is $20 per machine, which City Finance Director Greg Ziantara said doesn't cover the cost of licensing. An increase in fees would most likely affect all machines, which may bring concerns from tavern owners about rising costs. However, the city should at least cover its costs, if not more, in the licensing business. Taxpayers are asked to support a lot of items in the city budget, but subsidizing video game licenses should not be one of them. More troubling is setting a cap or reducing the number of available video gaming licenses. While the intent is understandable, it rarely works out well when government interferes in the free market economy. If gambling customers will support 338 terminals, then business should be allowed to offer that number. In addition, limiting the number of licenses could be opening up other issues. Previous councils have been asked to limit the number of payday and title loan establishments. While council members have been sympathetic to the issues surrounding these establishments, they have maintained the position that it is not a city responsibility to limit those types of businesses. If the council limits the number of gambling establishments, it may well be asked to look at limits on other businesses. It's surprising to many that Decatur can support so much gambling, and this is certainly a business category that grew faster than anyone anticipated. The best route for the city is to increase the licensing fees, but to hesitate before establishing limits on the number of licenses. And that's an editorial. This is a letter. Congrats to the Animal Control on their 10th anniversary. Congrats to Macon County Animal Control Center's 10th anniversary. This jewel of our county didn't come easily. Back in the day when I served as vice chair, the center was directly under the control of the county board. The center then was indeed a sorry sight. Thanks to the positive leadership of past chairman Dave Wolf, Bob Simpson, and Jay Dunn, the step was taken to move control under Sheriff Jerry Dawson and later Tom Schneider. The current and capable administrator is Sergeant Lou Ann Holland, and that was written by Steve Grimm from Decatur. This next letter, the city council should take action on the Sweeney Gleason issue. I am so tired of hearing about Brad Sweeney and Tim Gleason. They both broke the law and should be fired, both of them. Our city council is not doing what the people of Decatur hired them to do. It is our mayor's job to clean this mess up. Decatur needs to practice what it preaches, honesty. Right now, you are not doing it. The only way to handle this is to not let Sweeney return. He should be fired, and also fire Gleason. He broke the law because this matter is not going away. If the city council and mayor doesn't do their job next election, we the people will remember by voting the right way. And that was written by Patricia Taylor, Indicator. This next letter, please move more quickly on authorizing city volunteers. The city of Decatur has several departments that use volunteers. It takes the signature of the mayor and the city manager on that department form to make it legal for that person to serve on that department. Would the mayor and city manager please sign the forms that in some cases have had the volunteer waiting 7 months? I worry that we may lose good volunteers if they wait much longer. That was submitted by Jack Myatt from Decatur. And this is a column on in today's paper. It says, keep working on Clinton. Like many of your readers, I am deeply disappointed by Exelon's decision to close the Clinton Power Station next year. We must all keep fighting to prevent this closure from happening. For the people of Central Illinois, there is no more important issue than the lack of good-paying jobs. Not only Clinton, but Caterpillar as well as other large employers have announced job losses. The Clinton Power Station provides 700 good-paying jobs and another 1,200 indirect jobs, and more than $13 million in local tax revenue to our schools and local governments. If Chicago were to suddenly lose 250,000 jobs, which is the equivalent of the potential job loss for Central Illinois from the Clinton closure, there would be an outcry from Chicago politicians demanding that the General Assembly take direct action. Our task is made more difficult by the tone-deaf comments of Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who stated that the General Assembly has more important issues to tackle, and even went as far as calling it a bailout for the companies. Legislation that would place Illinois nuclear plants on a level playing field with renewables such as wind and solar, which are heavily subsidized by Illinois ratepayers, is not a bailout. Perhaps Attorney General Madigan has forgotten all of the Chicago bailouts the General Assembly has previously approved at a taxpayer's expense, or the special legislation for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, or several Chicago professional sports stadiums. The future of the Clinton Power Station isn't just a matter of jobs for our local economy. If Clinton closes, there will be massive rate increases for families throughout Central Illinois. Clinton is part of the MISO grid for our region, which is already experiencing capacity losses due to the closure of several coal-fired plants. According to a recent state analysis, MISO has calculated that energy prices would increase a minimum of $236 million annually, up to a high of $341 million annually if Clinton is taken off the grid. The Illinois General Assembly needs to be in Springfield every day throughout the month of June. There is still time to pass energy legislation that would ensure the continued safe operation of the Clinton and Quad Cities nuclear plants. Cranes reported last week that progress has been made on legislation to keep our nuclear plants at full operation. Efforts to keep Clinton open must be a bipartisan endeavor. I am working with a Democratic representative from the Quad Cities and local leaders to redouble our efforts in Springfield to reach an agreement to keep our nuclear plants open. We simply cannot afford to lose 700 good-paying jobs and $13 million in annual tax revenues while our electric rates skyrocket. This is a crisis that must be addressed by the General Assembly this month. I will keep fighting to make that happen. I think I'll turn to the obituaries at this point in time so that we make sure we get all of these in. From Decatur, Elva A. Binkley, 91, of Phoenix, Arizona, formerly of Decatur, passed away on Thursday, June 2nd in Phoenix with her family by her side. Funeral liturgy to celebrate Elva's life will be at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, June 11th, with Reverend John Burnett officiating. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 10th, at the funeral home. Burial will follow at the Graceland Cemetery. The family of Elva Binkley are being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue in Decatur. From Decatur, Robert Anthony, also known as Bob Baum, Jr., 64, currently from Palma Valley, California, formerly of Decatur, died on February 17, 2016. The Celebration of Life Mass will be at 2 p.m. Friday in St. Thomas Catholic Church. Visitation will be 1 hour before services in the church. From Clinton, James Jim H. Evans, 93, of Clinton, Illinois, passed away at 4:25 a.m. on June 6 at Manor Court in Clinton, Illinois. Graveside services will be at 12 noon on Friday, June 10th, at Woodlawn Cemetery, Edwardsville, Illinois, with Reverend Lillard Luttrell officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 9th, at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, Illinois. Memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Foundation or to a charity of the donor's choice. From Decatur, Carol M. Grieve, 69, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, June 5, 2016, at the Decatur Memorial Hospital. In keeping with Carol's wishes, cremation services will be performed by Graceland Fairlawn Crematory. There will be no services. From Decatur, Frances Elizabeth Hickey, 96, of Decatur, formerly of Springfield, passed away Sunday, June 5, in the home of her daughter and son-in-law, after a long illness. Her husband, Francis Hickey, preceded her in death on May 9th of 2006. The Mass of Christian Burial will be at 11 a.m. Friday, June 10th, at St. Cabrini Catholic Church in Springfield, with visitation 1 hour prior to services, Monsignor John Osceola celebrating. Burial will be in the Calvary Cemetery in Springfield. Brentlicker and Earl Funeral Home Indicator is assisting the Hickey family with arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Dominican Sisters of Springfield, Illinois. From Decatur, Freddie Lee Hodges. On June 1st at 8:30 p.m., the Lord called him home after suffering a brain aneurysm. Funeral services to celebrate the life of Freddie Lee Hodges will be at 11 a.m. Friday, June 10th, at Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, June 9th, at the funeral home, and also from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Friday, before the services at the funeral home. Burial will be in Camp Butler National Cemetery in Springfield, where military rites will be conducted. Memorials may be directed to AMELCA Food Pantry. From Decatur, Jeffrey Logan. Jeffrey Logan, 53, of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, June 4th, in Mason Point in Sullivan, Illinois. Honoring Jeff's wishes, cremation will take place at the Graceland Fairlawn Cremation Center. There will be no public services. From Decatur, Anton Masio Madison, Sr., of Seminole, Florida, formerly of Decatur, departed his life on May 20th, 2016, in Chicago, Illinois. Services will be at 11:30 a.m. Friday, June 10th, at the New Publican Primitive Baptist Church at 1042 East North Street, with visitation from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Walker Funeral Service is in charge of the arrangements. From Decatur, Cindy Irene Martin, 60, of Decatur, passed away on Sunday, June 5th, in her home with her family by her side. Graveside service to celebrate Cindy's life will be at 12 noon Thursday, June 9th, in the Macon County Memorial Park. From Forsyth, Donna Jean McKinley, 93, of Forsyth, Illinois, passed away at 12:54 a.m. June 6th at the Hickory Point Christian Village in Forsyth, Illinois. Funeral services will be at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, June 9th, at the Forsyth United Methodist Church in Forsyth, with Reverend Andrew Maxwell officiating. Burial will follow at Moroa Cemetery in Moroa. Visitation will be 9 a.m. until the time of service at the church. Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton, Illinois, is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Forsyth United Methodist Church. From Farmer City, E. Muriel Otto, 96, of Farmer City, passed away at 7:20 a.m. Monday, June 6, at the Farmer City Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, June 9th, at the Calvert Bellanger Bruce Funeral Home, Farmer City, with Pastor Jeremiah Thompson officiating. Burial will be in Grandview Memorial Gardens in Champaign, Illinois. Visitation will be from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Wednesday, June 8th, at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the Weedman United Methodist Church, P.O. Box 73, Farmer City, Illinois. From Decatur, Donald L. Robbins, 90, of Port St. Lucie, Florida, formerly of Decatur, died Friday, June 3rd, in his home. Private family memorial services will be held at a later date in Illini Congregational Cemetery in Harristown. From Decatur, Linda M. Scheich, 68, Box Elder, South Dakota, formerly of Decatur, Marine veteran, died May 1st, 2016. Celebration of life services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 16th at Serenity Springs Funeral Chapel in Rapid City, South Dakota. Burial 1 p.m. Thursday at the Black Hills National Cemetery in Sturgis, South Dakota. From Findlay, Richard, also known as Dick Franklin, either Winings or Winnings, 77, formerly of Findlay, passed away to be with his Lord Jesus Christ on Saturday, June 4th, 2016, at his son's home in Vonore, Tennessee. Visitation will be 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, June 10th, at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Findlay. Funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Burial will be at the Findlay Cemetery. And that's all of the obituaries for today. This next section is called Day by Day, and it's kind of a recap of important things that have happened on June 8th in years by gone by. In AD 632, the Prophet Muhammad died in Medina. In 1845, Andrew Jackson, 7th President of the United States, died in Nashville, Tennessee. In 1864, Abraham Lincoln was nominated for another term as president during the National Union, or the Republican Party's convention in Baltimore. In 1912, the ballet Daphne and Chloe were premiered by the Ballet Russe in Paris. In 1915, U.S. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan resigned over what he viewed as President Woodrow Wilson's overly bellicose attitude toward Germany following the sinking of the RMS Lusitania. In 1948, the Texaco Star Theater made its debut on NBC TV, with Milton Berle guest hosting the first program. Berle was later named the show's permanent host. In 1953, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that restaurants in the District of Columbia could not refuse to serve blacks. 8 tornadoes struck Michigan's Lower Peninsula, killing 126 people. In 1967, 34 U.S. servicemen were killed when Israel attacked the USS Liberty, a Navy intelligence gathering ship in the Mediterranean. Israel later said that the Liberty had been mistaken for an Egyptian vessel. In 1972, during the Vietnam War, an Associated Press photographer captured the haunting image of 9-year-old Phan T. Kim Phuc as she ran, naked and severely burned, from the scene of a South Vietnamese napalm attack. In 1978, a jury in Clark County, Nevada, ruled a so-called Mormon will, purportedly written by the late billionaire Howard Hughes, was a forgery. In 1982, President Ronald Reagan became the first American chief executive to address a joint session of the British Parliament. In 1996, China set off an underground nuclear test blast. In 2006, the Food and Drug Administration approved Gardasil, a vaccine against HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer. Sheikh Hala Al Khalifa, a lawyer from Bahrain, was elected UN General Assembly President, the first woman from the Middle East to take the post. In 2011, Representative Allison Schwartz of Pennsylvania became the first Democratic House colleague to call for Representative Anthony Weiner of New York to resign after he admitted selling a lewd photo of himself to a woman via Twitter and lying about it. OPEC unexpectedly left its production levels unchanged, causing oil prices to jump as senior officials reported their meeting in Vienna had ended in disarray. Meredith Vieira ended her 5-year run as co-anchor of NBC's Today Show, telling viewers her decision was right, but it's hard. In 2015, acknowledging setbacks, President Barack Obama said at the close of a G7 summit in Germany that the United States still lacked a complete strategy for training Iraqi forces to fight the Islamic State. Siding with the White House in a foreign power policy struggle with Congress, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that Americans born in the disputed city of Jerusalem could not list Israel as their birthplace on passports. The NCAA approved multiple rule changes to men's basketball for the 2015-16 season, including a 30-second shot clock and fewer timeouts for each team. And this article from Clinton. Tour provides students a taste for farming by Chris Lisvardi. A group of children got a taste Tuesday of what working on a farm is like during tours organized through the University of Illinois Extension DeWitt County office. The students, ranging in age from 7 to 10, learned about growing organic fruits and vegetables at Jubilee Farms and raising livestock at Nord Farms. The experience left them eager to come back for additional tours scheduled for today and Thursday. "That's only the beginning," said Josie Franklin, 10, as the tour of Nord Farms near Clinton drew to a close. Elizabeth Devers, 10, asked if the group could stay longer at each farm and help with some of the work, having enjoyed being around the plants and animals, including alpacas, chickens, and sheep at Jubilee Farms. The tours are intended to provide an opportunity for the children with a better understanding of where their food comes from, said Sherry Fulton, an Extension 4-H youth development educator. "Hopefully they come away thinking, I can do this," said Fulton, who led the tour along with Doug Gucker, an Extension local food systems and small farms educator. "You don't need a lot of ground to start a garden. They could create a hobby." Brock Wilson, 8 years old, enjoys gardening and wants to plant some of what he saw at Jubilee Farms, which Cindy Ash operates. "I love everything about it," Brock said. "I know it's some work." Ash said the farm requires a lot of her attention to manage as she uses land on a hillside. "There are things to do for those interested in farming other than corn and beans," Ash said. "A lot of opportunities are available in Illinois to produce food." Ash last year produced 1,000 pounds of potatoes, or the equivalent of 205-pound bags typically brought at grocery stores, using a relatively small amount of land. She hopes to grow more this year. The children were eager to pick and taste strawberries along with radishes they could take with them and to try with ranch dressing during lunch. "I hope my mom likes these," Josie said as she held a handful of freshly picked radishes. She can't refuse them now that her daughter picked them. Lucy Nord and her daughters, Elsie and Inga, explained to the group what it takes to raise cattle and horses, starting with a list of chores the girls are responsible for each day, including what needs to be done before leaving school and after they get home in the evening. "Living and working on the farm isn't all about hard work, as the girls enjoy being around the animals, including learning to ride cutting horses along with breeding and raising Charolais cattle. They say it's like an amusement ride," Lucy Nord said. "They get hooked and love it." Inga Nord said they show cattle at junior nationals in addition to county fairs and the Illinois State Fair. And there's a couple of pictures accompanying this article, a couple of young alpacas with a group of kids outside the fence. And kids in the middle of a strawberry field actually looks like they're eating more than they're picking. That would be Jack Potts, Elizabeth Devers, and Josie Franklin, and Lauren Bewley. They're picking and eating strawberries at the Jubilee Farms, mostly eating, it looks like. And just finishing up with a few short things. Today in history. In 1966, the strongest of a series of tornadoes struck the Topeka, Kansas area, killing 17 people. And another merger was announced between the National and American Football Leagues to take effect in 1970. The wine of the week is Alverde Pinot Grigio. It is the varietal is 100% Pinot Grigio, region from Italy. The wine description is marked by a fresh floral bouquet with notes of acacia flowers. This dry white wine is well balanced with lively white fruit flavors. Enjoy young for maximum flavor expression. Pairs well with any fish pasta and white meat, and also ideal as an aperitif. Price $9.99. That wine will be open for tasting at the Decatur Fine Wines this Saturday. And a spot of tea, the 30th Annual Fairy Garden Tea Party for Children and Adults will be at 10 a.m. to noon Saturday, June 11th at Mary Mann Herb Company off North St. Louis Bridge Road at 1405 Mary Mann Lane. The cost is $24 per person, and reservations must be made in advance by calling 429-1555. And that's all we have time for today. I hope you enjoy the second half of the Pantograph. You have a good day, and we'll be back with you tomorrow. This is Kathy signing off.